All right, so here's the, again, the schedule of what we're going to be doing here. Sunday we did an introduction, and I'm going to review just a couple things about that, but not too much. Next class is going to be on the Sabbath. And the reason that I want to spend a class on the Sabbath is because trivia. What chapter in Leviticus is the big chapter that gives an overview of all the feasts? Yeah, Leviticus 23. And Leviticus 23, it doesn't start out by talking about Passover. What's the first thing it talks about? The Sabbath. And so, I don't know if you guys ever liked to play with like Legos, but like was it the 2x2x1 or the 2x2x2 piece is like the foundational piece to build anything else with Legos, pretty much. You know what I mean? Maybe, I don't know. Okay. So like the Sabbath is the foundational day, because it's the seventh day of the week and everything, and all of the other feasts are going to have some kind of association with the number seven. So on Sunday, we'll talk about the importance of the Sabbath and what it meant and how Jesus fulfilled it and stuff like that, and use that as sort of the building blocks for the rest of what we're going to be looking at. And then we'll be doing two classes on the Passover. Daniel Grantham is going to be teaching kind of like what the Bible as a whole is saying in other places, like in the prophets and stuff like that about the Passover. And then we'll do unleavened bread, so on and so forth. There is going to be a change with the last two classes. Purim and Hanukkah are going to be added into the same class, so it's going to be kind of a survey of both of those. And then, are you going to be teaching Mason? Then Mason is going to do one on the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee. I'm going to be out of town at the beginning of April, so that's why Daniel and Mason are going to be covering that. Okay, so that's the schedule of what we're doing. Does anybody have any questions or anything just about the schedule? Okay. So, just by a quick review of what we did last time, I want to discuss these two questions to begin here. What were the purposes of the Jewish feasts? And then secondly, in what sense do Christians today still keep the feasts? So let's start out with the first question. What were the purposes of the Jewish feasts? And the answer to this question, by the way, is sort of becoming our goals for these classes. And we talked about three reasons why God gave these Jewish feasts. Anybody remember them?
Unify the people as a whole.
Okay, good. One of them was to bring the people to unity, to help them understand the importance of community. What was the Old Testament way in which people were stirred up to love and good works? It was these Jewish feasts where they would come together and remember the things of the Lord in community. All right, anybody remember any of the other purposes of the feasts?
Memorial.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, so to remember things that God has done in the past, very good. And there was another one, and that's more of the New Testament connection.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah, so the three purposes: to remember God's acts, to create national unity, and then thirdly, to foreshadow Christ. And in tonight's class, we're going to kind of touch a little bit on all of these. And then after this class, then we'll be talking about the specific feast. So this is kind of like a shotgun sort of class, but specifically dealing with what each feast was about. Okay, good. So second review question. In what sense do Christians today still keep the feasts? There's a sense in which we do, and there's a sense in which we don't. So what's the sense in which we do still keep the feasts? Okay, good. So the Lord's Supper is like the Passover. What else would we say about this question?
Well, in the sense that Christ was foreshadowed in all of the feasts, he is therefore the fulfillment of all the feasts.
Right.
So in Christ, we are, in some way, maybe that's a little bit difficult to understand, keeping the feast by our relationship with Christ.
Yeah. Michaela, were you going to say something? Okay, so, and Mason mentioned 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 8, about let us therefore keep the feast, and it's talking about Passover and unleavened bread, that in Christ we're keeping those in a sense. We're going to see on Sunday morning that Jesus would claim to give people rest, which is the idea of Sabbath. And so there's a sense in which the Christian is keeping the Sabbath, not in like a literal seventh day sort of thing, but the spiritual meaning of it is applied to the Christian. Does that make sense? Okay, and that'll be some of the cool connections that we see as we go through these classes. All right, so tonight what we're going to do is we're going to understand the Jewish calendar. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on that. Secondly, overview the seven Mosaic feasts. And then thirdly, discuss the history of the Jewish obedience to the feasts. Does that make sense? Anybody have any comments or questions before we start on this? Okay, I'm going to show you a chart that Daniel Grantham sent me that I think is going to be helpful to think about the nature of the Jewish calendar here. But you just notice on this chart, let me just ask this question. On the second page of this lesson, I asked the question that the scriptures commanded the Israelites to come to Jerusalem three times a year for the feasts. Why, if there are seven feasts, were the Israelites commanded to come only three times a year? Now, if you were to look at this chart here, how would you be able to answer that question? Why were they told to come three times a year if there were seven feasts? What do you mean by that?
They would come and celebrate three of the feasts during one day.
Yes.
In Jerusalem, and then the spring feast, they would celebrate three.
Yes. So you see, In the first trip, they knock out Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits over the course of 8 days. And then on the second trip, it's just one feast, and that's the Feast of Pentecost, 50 days later. Have you ever noticed with Pentecost, by the way, it doesn't give, like, the date of Pentecost. It just says 50 days after. It's like, well, why doesn't it just tell us the date? Why does it always say 50 days later? Maybe there'll be some things to say about that. I think there's a reason for that. So the first trip, they get three of the feasts done. The second trip, they only get one. The third, there's some debate if they actually would assemble for trumpets. I talked to a Jewish guy a couple weeks ago, and I asked him that question. And he said that the Jews don't actually assemble in Jerusalem for trumpets, but the text seems to kind of indicate that they do. Either way, in this, if they did, on this third trip, they would still span enough time to be able to get all three of those last feasts done. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. All right, I asked in the material, this you see how our calendar, this starts with January here, and it kind of like intersects here with how the Jewish calendar sort of works. Hopefully this chart, as you kind of keep looking at it and absorb what's happening with this, helps you see that the Jewish calendar functions differently than the Gregorian calendar that we have. But I asked in the material, you're not going to find like a Bible answer for this, but you'd have to do some like Wikipediaing on this or something. But what is the difference between the Jewish lunar calendar and our solar calendar? Anybody happen to know?
As far as days?
Just anything. What do you guys find?
For the question? Moves.
It moves?
I mean, relative to ours, it moves.
It's new moon. Back and forth.
Okay.
So with the lunar, they start with the new moon every month.
Right.
That, from new moon to new moon is considered a month. And it only goes for, when they add all those days up, it only comes up to like 354 days a year.
That's right.
And so with the solar, they actually go by the two equinoxes. So you have the spring and the fall equinox. And then they base that off the solar year, which is the orbit around the sun. So it's centered on the sun with the 365 days.
Right. So the next full moon is March 9th. And that's, for the Jewish people, that would be the beginning of their new month. Because it goes by what the moon is doing and not what the sun is doing necessarily. Mike?
So they're both accurate, but the solar calendar is Wikipedia, Professor Wikipedia.
Okay.
there has to be adjustments for the solar calendar. But really, the lunar calendar can be thought of as more accurate because the full moon falls on a different day each month than the solar calendar.
Right. Yeah, and that's why it would be like March 9th. And then for us, that's kind of the middle of the month, but for the Jews, that would be the beginning of it. So here's a quote that I took from a book that I made some changes with, so I don't have the quote marks, but I didn't come up with all this. And I'm going to do something that I'm not supposed to do. I'm just going to read what's on the PowerPoint. But this is a good explanation, I think, of the differences. And then, like I said, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. This is just a helpful thing to know to keep in the back of our mind as we look at the feasts. So, it says, the Jewish calendar is lunar. It is based on the movement of the moon around the sun. It takes approximately 29 and a half days for the moon to make a complete circle around the earth. I think I had a typo there with the sun, and it should have been earth. 12 of these lunar months add up to 354 days in a lunar year. Our solar year is about 11 days longer. To compensate or to calibrate for what everybody else does in the world, the Jews add a leap month at the end of every third year. So, okay. Really interesting. I don't know what else to really say about that. But because we're talking about the Jewish calendar and how the Jewish feast would function, I feel like I at least had to spend 2 minutes on that. Anybody have anything else they want to ask about that or say about that?
Just one quick thing. I think this is the leap year.
The leap month right now?
Yeah. The leap month is coming up, and it's like second Adar is what somebody was calling it. So.
Okay, they just added it. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know exactly the mechanics of it.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if they would keep any, like how they would keep feasts and stuff like that. But yeah, that's an interesting thing that they have to do for that. Okay, anything else you guys want to say about any of that? All right. So here's a chart that you probably can't read if you're sitting in the back, but it is in your material on page 4. And this is looking at the Jewish calendar just from another perspective. But you've just got the months listed out 1 through 12 here on a typical year that's not a leap year. And in page 4, I asked the question, how does Genesis chapter 1, verse 14 look forward to these feasts? Anybody get an answer for that? Yeah, what was the purpose of the sun, moon, and the stars in Genesis 1? Yeah, for the seasons that God was going to later have, which means that these seasons that God created for the nation of Israel, part of the way in which God created the world was for them to be able to honor these things and know when to do all of these things. So part of this is built into the fabric of creation in Genesis chapter 1, where he said, let there be the lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. What is one of the problems that later kings in 1st and 2nd Kings would introduce to the nation of Israel? What were some of the things that they would start to worship? Yeah, the sun and the moon. They'd worship the host of heaven, like Manasseh does that in 2 Kings chapter 21. So the very things that were created to help them know when to worship God properly, they started worshiping those things in and of themselves. So that's sort of an ironic thing that happened. But let me say a couple things about this chart here. All right. So the first month is Passover. Originally, it was the 7th month, and we'll say more about that when we get to the Feast of Trumpets. But Passover marked a new beginning for the nation. And so that became the first month of the year for them. And so in the first month, 14th day, that's 7 times 2. There's going to be sevens all over the place in these feasts. You've got the Passover. Anybody notice that in Numbers chapter 9, people who couldn't take of the first Passover got to take the second one? Go over to Numbers chapter 9.
I mean, didn't Hezekiah use that or... I mean, when they weren't pure, they hadn't been purified when Hezekiah was reforming.
This became part of their practice, based on Numbers 9, that they would take the second Passover.
Yeah.
So in Numbers 9, and Daniel's going to, I think, bring this passage up a little bit. There's some people that couldn't partake of the Passover when they took of it in the wilderness. But look at Numbers 9, starting in verse 9. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, if any one of you or of your descendants is unclean through touching a dead body, or he is on a long journey, he shall still keep the Passover to the Lord in the second month on the 14th day at twilight. They shall keep it. They shall eat it with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs. They shall leave none of it until the morning, nor break any of its bones, according to all the statute for this Passover that they shall keep. But if anyone who is clean and is not on a journey fails to keep the Passover, that person shall be cut off from his people, because he did not bring the Lord's offering at its appointed time. That man shall bear his sin. Okay. So there's maybe some New Testament sort of applications to some of this stuff, but Passover was mainly the first month, but there was a second Passover. What kind of people could take this second Passover?
Merchants.
Yeah, okay, people that were traveling, who else?
People who were ritually unclean.
People that were ritually unclean when it would have happened. But who couldn't take the second Passover?
Those who willingly denied the first Passover.
Yeah, people that like could have been there, but they weren't. Can you think of any applications from this, from like morning and evening service? Are there legitimate times where maybe somebody can't be there on a Sunday morning? Does that happen sometimes? And maybe are there some things to say about offering the Lord's Supper Sunday nights too? Does God understand in situations when somebody couldn't be there? I'm not saying that this is talking about Passover or the Lord's Supper. But does this say something about the nature of God's character to understand if somebody couldn't be there for the first offering of something and then they could come back for a second one? I don't know how much to make of that, but I think it's interesting that God in his character allowed that to happen. And so they did, and like you brought up in Hezekiah, that was something that was relevant at another time as well. So that's the first 2 months out of the year. Anybody have anything that they want to say about any of that as we're going through this? Okay, so after the first three feasts of the year were done, there was a 50-day period of time where then they have Pentecost or first fruits. I'm going to say more about that in just a little bit, but you notice this big gap right here. You've got the fourth, fifth, and sixth month where there are no there's no Jewish feasts, and then suddenly in the seventh month. Why do you think the seventh month would be a month for three more things? It's the seventh. Yeah, like this is the Sabbath month. This is the month where they would do the Feast of Booths, Day of Atonement, Feast of Trumpets. These are all very, very important ones. This is also when the early rains started. And so for us, September, October. So when I lived in Southern California, one of the things that I really liked about living there is that it's the same climate as Israel. And so, it's a Mediterranean sort of climate. That's why it's such a nice place to live and stuff. And so whenever I was trying to imagine Bible stories, I was able to understand the Jewish calendar, and even like when Moses sees a burning bush in a wilderness that's like all dry, why isn't it being consumed? This isn't like a wet tree or anything like that. And so for us in California, the rains would come in September, October. And so some of these feasts might have something to do with expecting more rain, especially the Feast of Booths and stuff like that. Then you get into the plowing season after the rain. Hanukkah and Purim come later. But the feasts that are in months 1 through 7, these are the ones that are actually recorded in the Law of Moses. And so we're not going to spend a lot of time on these other ones. I asked this on Sunday morning, but does anybody know where we read about Hanukkah in the Bible? You're not going to see that name in the Bible, but where do we read Hanukkah in the Bible? John chapter 10, it's wintertime. Jesus is at the temple in the wintertime, and there's some interesting connections with that. There's an Old Testament prophet that talked about Hanukkah. Anybody know who that was?
Daniel.
Daniel, the statue and everything, and then chapter 11 especially is a very detailed prophecy. Where do we read about Purim?
Well, I guess it might be important to point out it's not a prophecy of the feast. It's a prophecy of the
events. Of the events that were celebrated.
Commemorating.
Yeah. Purim.
Esther.
Yeah, it's the Book of Esther, and so that's the calendar from that other perspective. I asked the question, what happened at the beginning of every new month? And I didn't give you all the right passages to look at. So what did you guys get, though, for that? Okay, good. So every time there's a new moon, like March 9th, I think that's going to be on a Monday, they would blow the trumpets. What else would they do?
Make sacrifices, offerings.
Yeah, they would make offerings, and those are detailed in Numbers 28, verses 11 through 15. They would have a burnt offering. They'd have two bowls, and then each bowl would have a corresponding grain and wine offering. They would have one ram, which would have a corresponding grain and wine offering, seven male lambs, which would have a corresponding grain and wine offering, and then finally one male goat for a sin offering.
Now, did everybody offer this, or was this just there was two bulls, one lamb?
These were the ones that were at the temple, like at the tabernacle. Like, this isn't like every household doing this. Yeah. By the way, anybody know what happens with the grain offerings in Leviticus? And then
aren't they all burned up?
Not all of it.
Like a burnt offering.
For the priests, yeah. So in Leviticus 2:16, some of it was there was a burned portion that goes to the Lord, and then the rest of it, according to Deuteronomy or Numbers 18, would go to the priests. So how would the priests take care of themselves? How would they eat? Well, every month they're offering all this kind of stuff, and they're always getting portions of these grain offerings that they're offering up to them. So, any comments or questions about this stuff? This is just kind of building block information that, like, right now we're like, well, why does this matter? Well, number one, it's in the Bible. But we're trying to understand the Jewish culture and how all of this eventually looks forward to Jesus. This is what they would have done, though, for each new moon. Anything else you guys want to say about that?
I don't quite know what to make of this, but it's interesting that the feast that they're commanded to assemble for do fit neatly into the agricultural calendar.
Yes.
So it's not too much of a disruption to their daily lives, and yet it is a little bit of a sacrifice. Anyway, maybe it highlights God's attempt to
show that he was the source of all of their blessings.
I think that's, yeah.
They're assembling at these key moments when they first harvest, right before they go plow. They're getting together and celebrating what God's done in their past.
Yes. Yeah, and so notice then, you've got the first fruits during the week of unleavened bread. It's not the same thing as Pentecost. There are two feasts that involve first fruits. That's something that not a lot of people realize. I didn't realize it till recently, actually. But first fruits was during the week of unleavened bread, and that's different from Pentecost. But both of them, they're offering first fruits, but the first one is the first fruits of barley, and on Pentecost, it's the first fruits of wheat. And when we get to the Feast of First Fruits, we're gonna get the distinctions in our mind, and there's going to be a lot of cool New Testament applications or parallels to that. Okay, so those are just some things about the Jewish calendar. What I want to do now is kind of shift and talk about the meaning of each one of these Mosaic feasts. And so if you guys go to the next chart, that'll be helpful to look at on page 5. And I asked you guys on question B to briefly explain the purpose of each feast. So let's just go through them, and I'm going to group a couple of them together because they oftentimes go together, and just see what you guys found for this. So Passover and Unleavened Bread, and also, I guess, So Passover and Unleavened Bread, let's put those together because they oftentimes go together. What was the purpose, not for the New Testament Christian, but what was the original intent or the original purpose of the Passover and Unleavened Bread? Okay, so leaving from Egypt. Anything else that you guys would say about that?
The Passover was to pass over their sins if they had the blood on the lintel of the door.
Right, so the Passover is more connected with specifically the death of the firstborn and then the Israelites being spared from that. Danny?
So you have this idea of deliverance from bondage. So you kind of see this, that'll show itself up in the New Testament.
Okay, good.
And care in the wilderness.
With the unleavened bread? Yeah, because when they have to leave... Have you guys ever noticed that in John 6, when Jesus multiplies the bread for the people, does anybody know what festival it was during that he did that? In John 6, verse 4? It's during Passover that he does it, and that's when he feeds the 5,000. I think John's account's the only one that tells us when it happens. And so it's during this time period that he does that. The Lamb of God is multiplying all this bread for people, and what does he say later in the chapter about eating his flesh and drinking his blood, that you have to do that? What did they do with the Passover lamb? They didn't drink its blood, but what did they do with its flesh? They ate it. So like he's couching all of this in Passover kind of language. John's gospel especially is going to say a lot about that. But you see that those things do go together. Jesus is the bread in the wilderness. They leave. They didn't have time to bake all of their bread. And so they would have eaten that, but then God is sending manna, so some of that would have reminded them of how God did all of that. So Passover unleavened bread is redemption from slavery or harsh work. One of the things that's interesting about the seven feasts is that if all of these are, like, if the building block of all of these feasts is the Sabbath, what is the meaning of Sabbath?
Rest.
Try to think about how every one of these feasts, in one way or another, connects to the concept of rest. Can you see how this first one does? This one's a little more obvious. You don't have to work in Egypt anymore as slaves, so there's a sense that you get rest now from that. Okay, so anything else you guys want to say about the Passover and unleavened bread? Okay, I'm going to group first fruits and weeks together. And what would you guys say that first fruits and Pentecost or weeks would be the meaning for them? What was that?
God's blessings.
Okay, good. God's blessings. He's providing us the things that we need.
In the land specifically.
Yeah. Did you look at this in Leviticus 23. In Leviticus 23, this is the first of the verses 9 through 14 is the Feast of First Fruits. Again, this is the one that takes place during the week of unleavened bread. And it says in Leviticus 23, starting in verse 9, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, When you come into the land that I give you and reap its harvest, you shall bring the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest, and then they're going to wave it before the Lord and stuff like that. So when is it that they were actually able to celebrate first fruits and weeks? And the same thing applies to the Feast of Weeks, by the way, because it's stuff that they're farming.
Had to enter the land.
Yeah, they had to be in the promised land. Okay, do you see how those feasts connect to the idea of rest? How did those feasts connect to the idea of rest and Sabbath?
They were no longer wandering in the wilderness.
They weren't wandering in the wilderness. What did you say, Russ?
They weren't traveling anymore.
Yeah, so they're not traveling, so they have rest in that way. Maybe there's something to be said about how if they're having an abundance of produce, it's sort of overcoming the curse of the land that it was going to bring forth thorns and thistles. Like there's kind of an overcoming of that in a sense. Although I'm sure there still would have been thorns and thistles. But
so,
yeah, Mason?
In Leviticus 23:14, it specifically says you don't eat anything you've harvested until you make this offering.
Yeah.
Which I think was a reminder that you don't get anything in the promised land until God gives it to you.
Right.
Until God decides you're ready and takes you in. Which is, of course, what happened. God said, decided they weren't ready, and they spent 40 more years wandering in the wilderness.
Right. Good. So, yeah, you can think, like, okay, if you get a raise at work or, like, you get unexpected, some kind of an unexpected, like, blessing in some way, like, whatever. Like, this would have been training them over and over and over again that all the things that I have come from who?
God.
From God. Do you think that the South is pretty wealthy? Compared to maybe other parts of the country? I mean, I think it is. Okay, so, yes, according to me. Do you think there could be a temptation to start to think that it's by my work and by my hand that I've got all the things that I have? And that can be a temptation for anybody, I don't care where you live. But these feasts would have reminded them that it's God that's taken care of you. And so, therefore, God gets the first of everything that you have. And so, all right, that's the first fruits and weeks. Anything else you guys want to say about that one? Yeah, Danny?
There's almost this idea as well that through that 50 weeks, while they're anticipating coming to Pentecost, this trust and confidence in God that he's going to continue to bless them through this harvest.
Yes.
That's taking place.
Yeah, there's almost a sense in which these are kind of representative of what they expect to continually have. And we're going to say a lot more about that when we get to those specific feasts and start to look at more of the details of those. But
is there some tradition that Pentecost also reminded them of the giving of the law?
Yes.
50 days approximately after they left Egypt.
Right, yeah. The Jewish people started to...
It's not in the scripture, I don't think.
Right, but it's about the same amount of time from the original moment of Passover that they get to Mount Sinai. And then when you look at the New Testament parallel to that, 50 days after Jesus is crucified, what do they receive?
The
gospel. Holy Spirit.
Yeah, the giving of the new law. And when Moses is receiving the law on Mount Sinai, they start worshiping the golden calf, and how many people are killed by the Levites?
3,000.
And then in Acts chapter 2, when they're giving the Spirit, how many people are saved? 3,000. So there's some interesting parallels with all of those and reversals and stuff like that. Okay, so very good. Anything else about the first fruits and weeks? All right, let's move then to trumpets. This is a harder one to nail down. But what do you guys find is the purpose of the Feast of Trumpets?
They were not to work.
Yeah, this was one of the high Sabbath days, as they're called.
So that would be rest.
Yeah. So you see how it's associated with the idea of Sabbath too. It's actually a Sabbath day.
Mm-hmm.
Good. What else? And maybe you say like it's the announcement of the seventh month. That's one maybe pretty definite thing we can say is that seven is an important number, so it makes sense that every new moon we do this blowing of the trumpets and stuff like that. We're going to make this an extra special one because this is the special month. But anybody have any other ideas on what the Feast of Trumpets was all about and what it was memorializing?
Well, maybe the walls falling and the Jews marching around Jericho.
Yeah, what did
the trumpets?
Yeah, they had that happens after this, but could God, knowing what's going to happen, give them the instructions here? That could be part of it. Any other ideas?
I mean, is it sort of a mini, like, jubilee? Because there's every 7 years they give the rest, but in the 50th year, So, I mean, kind of just playing on the fact you're saying every month trumpet, and here's the seventh month, and then here's this extra day.
Right.
It would almost seem an echo of the year of Jubilee. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure. Is that what...
I think, like, every week is kind of a microcosm of that on the Sabbath day. And then, again, that's where you get the building block thing and the great Lego illustration and stuff like that.
And this also would be a type of pause. So if you think about when they were told, when they would do their harvest, one of the things that they were instructed is leave the corners of the fields undone. This was for the poor. And so we see that happening in the book of Ruth with Boaz allowing that to happen. So I wonder if this was God's way, just like we understand he placed the Sabbath weekly, the year of Jubilee, the idea of restoring the land, allowing it to recover, that this was God's way of saying, put your trust in him that this system works.
Yeah.
That when you follow God's way of doing something, which would not be our modernistic approach to things, God's way of accomplishing things, this is the best way. This is where we receive the greatest blessing when we're doing things according to his plan.
Right. Well, and even in the Sabbath year, what are they not supposed to do in the seventh year? They're not supposed to plow.
Yeah.
Did they ever obey that command? No. So what did God do? He gave the land 70 years of rest. And have you ever wondered why it was 70 years? It's because they weren't giving the land the rest that it needed. So he gave it a mega Sabbath of 70 years. So, okay. So that's one purpose for the Feast of Trumpets. Another one, it seems to commemorate the giving of the Torah also, because when God descended on Mount Sinai, what sounds were given at the time? Sound of a trumpet. So some of these feasts, I think, kind of connect back to some of the same things. And then also, a lot of people would say that this starts the preparation for the Day of Atonement, because in 10 days they're going to be doing the Day of Atonement. It's a very solemn day. They have to be repenting of any sins that's in their life, all of that sort of thing, in order to prepare for that, in a sense, judgment that's about to happen. So if you weren't right with God. Okay, so that's Feast of Trumpets. Anything else you guys want to say about that one?
I have no idea if this has anything to do with it, but didn't they blow trumpets to announce when to leave camp?
Yes.
The wilderness? And so that was kind of, you know, after a period of time that they've been in camp for a while, and it's, you know, leading the way to, hey, you're going towards more of God's provision wherever he's taken you. It's kind of leading the way into these next few feasts. I don't know.
Yeah, when we actually talk, like, and do our class on the Feast of Trumpets, we'll talk about Numbers 10. And the different uses for the trumpets to try to dial down what exactly is this feast about. Danny?
So, correct me if I'm wrong, Jehoshaphat, when he was king, I can't remember who specifically he sent out. He sent them out to blow trumpets. And by blowing the trumpets, he was calling all to come to the reading of the law. He brought back the teaching of the law that had been abandoned.
Yeah, whenever they would have an assembly, they would use the trumpets to call people together. And so that, like, one of the New Testament parallels of this in Matthew 24, when Jesus is not talking about the end of the world, but he talks about the Son of Man coming and, like, all, like, the sun, moon, and stars are going to be destroyed and everything like that. And then he says that the trumpet call will go out, or whatever, however exactly he says that. What's he talking about there? Like, first of all, I didn't even quote it right. Now I'm asking you to tell me what it means. Do you guys know what I'm talking about in Matthew 24? All right, let me just read this quick then. Because this is maybe one of the New Testament parallels to the Feast of Trumpets. In Matthew 24, in verse 29... Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. Then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to another. What is this talking about? If one of the purposes of the trumpets was to call the assembly together, what is it that calls people all around the world together in the same church? The gospel does. And so Isaiah 27 talks about the trumpet being called to gather God's people back together and stuff like that. So, but again, we'll talk more about that as we get when we get to that class. All right, Day of Atonement. What is the purpose of this one? Yeah. Yeah, so God is cleansing his people so he can dwell with them. Oh, how does that connect with the idea of rest and Sabbath? How do you think the people would feel after the high priest left the most holy place and he had done his job?
Relieved.
Yeah, relieved. Like, so it's the idea of rest from your sins and stuff like that, which never really perfected them, but at least for 2 minutes, people probably felt pretty good. So that's the Day of Atonement. And then finally, Tabernacles. What's the purpose of that one? Right, so yeah, when they left Egypt, they were living in tents and stuff. Like, have you ever wondered in the Transfiguration when Peter doesn't know what to say and he sees Moses and Elijah there? He's like, hey, let's build a tent for all of you guys. And people oftentimes say, well, he must be talking about building a tabernacle for all of them. Like, he's equating all of these all as being like divine beings or something like that. I'm not sure about that. Like, I wonder if it was taking place during the Feast of Tabernacles. He's saying, hey, let's go ahead and like do this for all of us or something. I'm not sure. But the idea of it was celebrating God's provision on their way to the Promised Land, and this is the only feast where they were actually commanded to rejoice. So for the Jewish people, this was like the most exciting festival that they had. And again, when we get to that one, we'll talk about that as well. But anything else you guys want to say about that one? All right, here's the chart that you have in the material then. If you want to draw all of this to Jesus, you could say that Passover was about Jesus' death. Unleavened bread is about Jesus' purity and also how he's the bread of life in our wilderness. He's the first fruits. It's going to connect to Jesus' resurrection. And the calendar is actually going to line up quite literally. And we'll talk about that when we get there. Pentecost is Acts 2 with the Spirit gets poured out. Trumpets, you could say, is the call to repentance and also Jesus gathering his people with the gospel call. Day of Atonement is Jesus' atoning sacrifice that goes deeper than just the external but cleanses our conscience, like Hebrews talks about. And then Booths is Jesus' ability to provide in the wilderness, and it's also connected with the giving of the Spirit, and we'll see that in John chapter 7. That's just a quick overview of the feasts. I want to spend a little time doing this then. I've been trying really hard to figure out where I see these things in the Old Testament. And I've been trying to do word searches and all this kind of stuff. But the times in the Old Testament history where we actually see the Israelites keeping the feasts, this isn't all of the ones that I know are in the Bible, but if you were to combine Passover, unleavened bread, and first fruits together, we know that Josiah did it. We know that when they entered into the Promised Land, they did Passover. And when in Ezra 6, they're keeping the Passover. I'm not aware of any time in biblical history where we see them keeping Pentecost. I'm not saying that they didn't, but I don't know of anywhere in the Old Testament where we see them doing it. Trumpets, maybe, is Ezra 3:1, maybe. Day of Atonement, maybe Ezra 3:6, but that's a maybe. Feast of Booths, for sure, Ezra and Nehemiah, we see them doing it. Nehemiah is very, very clear that they're keeping it there. Okay. So I got a couple questions about this that you guys with the people next to you can discuss. I want you to look at this time when Josiah institutes or reinstitutes the Passover and talk about this question with the people next to you, these questions. What does 2 Kings 23:21-23 tell us about how Israel kept the Passover throughout their history? And then what period of the Old Testament do we see Israel keeping the feasts most, according to this chart anyways? And then thirdly, what lessons can you draw from Israel's lack of obedience to the feasts? So look at 2 Kings and use that as a launching pad to talk about these questions with the people next to you.
Harry,
district somewhere up in there, you would have to throw Hannah in there. You don't know what they did, but every year it would go to the tabernacle.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So you don't know which one, but somewhere in there, Hannah did. Yes.
Yeah, by the way, if anybody has anything to add to my chart, please let me know, because I want to try to make this as complete as I can. Alright, because we don't have a ton of time, what are you guys seeing with this one, with Josiah reinstituting the Passover? Yeah, so there's some questions, like, is he saying that, like, they literally didn't keep it since...
No.
Yeah, what do you think he's saying then, Daniel?
Well, it's to the extent in which Josiah offered the Passover's prior, like in the days of Solomon and Hezekiah, just did not compare to what Josiah had done.
Right, so is what Josiah did good or bad then?
What Josiah did was great.
It's great. Which means that if they were keeping it in the times of these other people, it wasn't notably so. And I think that, like, it would be one thing to say, well, they just weren't doing it, and I don't think that's the case. It's like, you could say, like, well, I go to church every week. Yeah, but are you, like, really going? You know what I mean? Like, it seemed like for years they had been doing the Passover, but they weren't doing it, like, with their whole heart into it, like what Josiah did for the people. And so I think there's an application from that. Like, I'm not convinced that they were keeping all of these feasts, like, all the time. But this passage here in 2 Kings certainly at least tells me that when they did it, it wasn't fully unto the Lord that they were doing it. And so it's notable when they finally did. Were you going to say something, Mike? Or no, Danny?
Well, in the days of Josiah, you've got to remember they're in the shadow of Manasseh.
Yes.
So
55 years of forgetting about God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Danny?
And that's, there was, you know, they had idolatry and the idolatrous practices of their own feast in direct competition with this. And when you look at what they had, the idolatrous stuff looked much more attractive. It was much more fun, much more enjoyable to do those.
It was more modern, too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Than to do Moses was written 900 years before that.
Right.
Yeah.
And sometimes what is written isn't respected.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You kind of let things go. Maybe there's... Because the stress in verse 21 is keep it as it is written.
Yes, and that's why, okay, so this second question, what period do we see them? I'm not saying that they didn't keep it the other times, but what period of Old Testament history do we see it emphasized that they were doing it now? When they finally returned from exile, God had to punish them for them to finally wake up and get it. And if you start to think about application to like how we take the Lord's Supper and stuff like that. Like, is our heart really into it with even what we're about to do in the auditorium? So, anyways, we'll say more about these ideas as we go through these classes, but thanks for your good attention.